talking about the Newtonian n-body problem, but applying the underlying ideas that belong to shape dynamics. And the underlying principle in shape dynamics is applied to, let's take the simplest toy model of the universe, the Newtonian three-body problem, is that the true degrees of freedom are just the shape of the triangle. So this, in Newtonian theory, you'd have lots of degrees of freedom where all the particles are, but in shape dynamics, it's just the shape of the triangle that counts. And when you look at Newtonian theory in those lights, a rather surprising new aspect of the problem of the origin of the arrow of time comes to light. So let's have a look at, first of all, Ludwig Boltzmann. We all know that he struggled heroically with his H theorem and the growth of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics. I think he died disappointed that he didn't really succeed in solving all the problems. This is a famous version of the best he could do with Poincaré recurrences, that every now and then there are huge fluctuations in the entropy of the universe, and that's where the interesting things happen. And you have this picture of, first of all, the direction of entropy growth determines the direction of the arrow of time. And you have, in addition, a one past two future scenario. Here's a past, and those are two future directions going out from there. And you have to wait eons in between. So that's the sort of the final story that I think we have from there. Let me just remind you of sort of modern ways of thinking about the arrow of time and so forth. Here's the famous Narset's timeline. Basically, it involves, today I think most people would say you have to invoke something like a past hypothesis to explain why there is structure formation. It's only possible, they say, because there's a very low entropy, which means that the universe began in a very low entropy state. And that's here, some sort of pre-inflation state was a very special one. I think that's broadly the majority view. And it involves expansion of space as well. Now, in shape dynamics, expansion of space has no meaning. We regard that as a gauge parameter. So now let's go on and look at the next thing. This is the very simplest Newtonian, non-trivial Newtonian problem you can have, the three-body problem. What is happening here is that every generic solution for the energy zero situation, and we're showing it here for zero angular momentum, there is a central region of non-trivial three-body interaction, and in both directions, the solution breaks up into a receding pair of particles which approximate ever better a Kepler motion, and a third particle which is going off in the opposite direction. But there is, because of time reversal symmetry of Newtonian and Einsteinian equations, a priori there's absolutely no sense in which you can put a time orientation, say time is going that way or that way. But if we say time is going this particular way, here's the particle coming in, approaching a Kepler pair coming from the other direction. There's a non-trivial interaction. The Kepler pair is broken up. They swap partners. But one particle goes, a different particle goes off to infinity, and the Kepler pair it forms down there. So that's the picture that you get there. Now, just concentrate on the successive shapes of the particles. I'm showing you basically what the successive shapes look like. I have to depict them as some size, but that's just because we can't imagine a triangle without drawing it on a piece of paper. So all I want you to look at is the shape. Now, when we're out in this asymptotic region, the shape is very like a needle because the third particle is very far away from the Kepler pair. The Kepler pair will be going around in its orbit like that. But basically, you will have a needle. But as you come into the central region, the interaction region up here, that all possible shapes of the triangle will be realized, including things close to the equilateral triangle, and it goes out on the other side in exactly the same. Now, if you look at that, it's very like that picture we saw of Boltzmann. We have, but this is purely dynamical. There's nothing to do with statistical fluctuations in this. This is every single generic solution of the Newtonian three-body problem with zero energy. You have a one past, if you call this the past, there's two futures going out from it. Now, that's a very simple model, very elementary. But that's the sort of thing we're suggesting. So this is still very tentative, but I think we're seeing a hint here that the arrow of time is nothing whatever to do with a special initial condition. It is solely due to the form of the law. It's not for every law, it's a particular law, and in this case it's the Newtonian three-body problem with exactly zero energy. But that is a law of the complete universe. So let me now introduce what is perhaps really key and new in this. I'm going to now forget all about gravity for the moment and say, suppose we had a collection of n particles with given masses in space, in Euclidean space, and I want to define some measure which measures the complexity or the degree of clustering of that collection of particles. And I want it to be dimensionless. I want it to be a pure number. Now, if it's going to be dimensionless in length, I must take a ratio of two lengths. And if you have n particles, there are just two numbers which stand out at you very emphatically as really the only sensible, simple candidates to take. One is the root mean square length. So that's the expression for it up there. The root mean square, sorry, the, so you first of all take the mean square length, and then you're going to take the square root of it. But this is actually the expression for the center of mass moment of inertia, which is one of the key quantities in the Newtonian n-body problem. So there's your two different expressions. These are the position coordinates relative to the center of mass. This is the an alternative identical expression for it. There's the total mass. So this is completely dimensionless in mass, but not yet in, you can't make it dimensionless, obviously, because of those lengths. Now that's the root, so if you take the square root of that, that's the root mean square length associated with the distribution. The other one, which is a candidate, is what is called the mean harmonic length, and that turns out to be the inverse of the Newton potential. So the mean harmonic length is the inverse of the Newton potential. And to get some dimensionless quantity which characterizes clustering, you multiply one by the other. And this is completely dimensionless, both in terms of mass and length. It's a pure number, absolutely pure number. Depends only on the number of particles and the mass ratios. And this is a very, very interesting quantity because it's essentially the Newton potential, but it's taken out that part of the Newton potential which generates forces towards the center of mass. So it's only generating forces that change the shape. Bill, a question.
The V Newton you want to divide by the total mass, square?
I should do that, yes. Thank you for that observation. We haven't got it in there. Yes. There should be a power of the mass in here to make it totally dimensionless. But the mass anyway you can take out without any problem because it remains constant. So you get this, so the shape potential, this quantity we've defined here, it generates forces that change the shape of the configuration without affecting its size. And I find it truly remarkable that the simplest quantity you can use to characterize the complexity of a collection of particles is simultaneously the potential that governs the evolution of its shape, which in our view is the only thing that's objective. If you have if the whole world is just three particles and you took snapshots of it, the only objective information, if you take out any external scale or any external time or something, is just the shape of the triangle. And the whole of objective history of such a universe is just its succession of shapes. And I find it very interesting that if you take that quantity which measures the clustering, it's simultaneously the one that generates Newtonian gravity of the as manifested objectively. And you can clearly see that the complexity is a very sensitive measuring of the clustering of particles, because this changes very little. If you've got lots of particles, this is essentially changes very little if two particles come next to each other, whereas the Newton potential is ultraviolet divergent. So you bring two particles together and you make that as big as you like. So it's a very sensitive measure of clustering.
Can I just ask, you could have taken any power and averaged over the mass.
You could have done, but I always start with the simplest. As Einstein says, start with the simplest. Yes. Make things as simple as you can, but not too simple.
Okay. The interpretation of the Newton is put in the hand. I mean, the Newton potential is put in the hand. It doesn't come out.
No. I was struck by this reading somewhere, quite independently of this. I came across these definitions of the two fundamental lengths associated with a collection of particles. One is the root mean square length, and the other is the mean harmonic length.
still don't understand whether they're special, and any power would have, and I don't want to hold
yes,
it
yes, up. But powers are a bit right. more than there's more power in them than there. Let's do it linearly if we can, so to speak. Yeah, but observations first. Right. So now what we've shown here, now you can plot the shapes of a triangle on the surface of a two-dimensional sphere. At the north pole, we have the equilateral triangle and its mirror image at the south pole. So every point here with a given latitude and longitude has a mirror image in the southern hemisphere. The equilateral configurations are around the equator. Here is on this shaped sphere, we have plotted the equipotentials of the shape potential. It has an absolute maximum for any value of the masses at the equilateral triangle. That's a result due to Lagrange. Then there are three saddle points, which are called Euler configurations, where you've got one particle between the other two here, and then you have these three places where you have two body coincidences there. This is very significantly, I think this is the most uniform state that that universe can have. So let's go on to the next one. Now I wanted to mention about dynamical similarity and something called the Lagrange-Jacobi relation. The Newton potential is homogeneous of degree k minus 1. Now whenever you have a potential that is homogeneous of some degree, you have something called dynamical similarity, which is of the following. So here's a potential, any potential V, which is homogeneous of some degree k, you get this transformation. If you multiply the positions by a constant, then you get that out. That's the definition of a potential that is homogeneous of degree k. And then it's a result for any potential in Newtonian theory. If you make that transformation to the coordinates and make a matching corresponding transformation of the times, you get another solution of the equations of motion. And the most famous example of this is Kepler's third law, where this turns out to be the 2/3 power. And ellipses are mapped to ellipses, identical ellipses that are traversed at a different speed. So that's dynamical similarity there. It's very important for the virial theorem as well. Now I want to say that the time derivative of the center of mass moment of inertia is this quantity here, which we call the dilatational momentum. Now we come to the Lagrange-Jacobi relation, which says that the second derivative of the moment of inertia is 4 times the total energy minus 2 into k plus 2 times the potential. Now we're going to assume that the energy is non-negative. So if the energy is non-negative and we take the Newton potential where k is minus 1, we get this expression here. The second derivative of the moment of inertia is equal to this thing. The Newton potential is negative definite, so this makes that thing positive. So if the energy is non-negative, this quantity is positive, which means next that the dilatation, the time derivative of the dilatational momentum is positive and d is monotonic. And equally important, the moment of inertia is concave upwards. It goes through a minimum where d is equal to 0, and it goes up to plus infinity in both directions, the moment of inertia. And this, by the way, is a clear division of the each trajectory into two halves. So let's just have a look again, just to remind you of that picture there of the Kepler pair interaction. But now I want to show you what that looks like when you plot these things. So this is a plot of various quantities as a function of time. First of all, and this is a numerical calculation that Flavio did, here is the moment of inertia plotted. You see it's a beautiful U-shaped curve. It's not completely smooth, and it has a different slope on the two sides. And you see that in its time derivative, the dilatational momentum, this is growing, going up there, but with a different slope. But the only thing that is directly observable is the complexity. That's the only thing that you could observe complexity, is the complexity. And you see that this is growing with humps like this, but it's growing monotonically. Now, the fluctuations are due to the ellipticity of the Kepler pair. It's the Newton potential is changing, But because of that third particle going away, the moment of inertia is growing effectively linearly in the limit. So we get a strict lower bound, which is linearly rising. So here we have an arrow of time of dynamical origin. So it's nearly time for me to hand over to Flavio. In fact, it is time to hand over to Flavio. Right, there you are. Oh, yes.
Sorry for the interruption. I'm gonna give you the rest of the details of this thing. So our idea was to reverse engineer Newton here and try to remove any reference to scales and describe everything intrinsically on shape space. The idea is to use this guy here, which you see is monotonically growing because of this in Lagrange-Jacobi relation here, as an evolution parameter, as your independent variable, and deparameterize the system with respect to it. So in detail, the thing works like this. The sphere, the shape sphere, where you parameterize all the possible triangles, is two-dimensional, so it can be parameterized through two polar angles. And pi will be their conjugate momenta, and they will satisfy canonical Poisson brackets like this. Now the system has zero energy and satisfies an Hamiltonian constraint because we start from a description that is reparametrization invariant, analog to the EDM formulation of GR. The Hamiltonian constraint can be written for this simple three-body problem in this way, in which we have evidence. All the dependence on scales, which comes through this center of mass moment of inertia, its square root here, which together with the shape potential forms the Newton potential, and this d squared here, the dilatational kinetic energy. If we want to use d as time, as an independent parameter, we can solve this constraint with respect to ICM and use the log of this quantity, which is canonically conjugate to d, as our Hamiltonian, which generates d translations through Poisson brackets. The solution is this, and as you can see, it depends on this dilatational momentum. A reference value for it, which is used just to make it dimensionless, so you can pick it up wherever you want, as long as it's not where d is equal to zero. And let's notice one thing, that this Hamiltonian is very similar to another Hamiltonian that you can imagine on shape space, which is actually the simplest one you could write. It is the Hamiltonian that generates geodesics, affinely parameterized. The geodesics of a metric on shape space, which is just a round metric on the sphere, conformally transformed through CS, through this complexity function, or minus the shape potential. This Hamiltonian generates curves that keep going around shape space endlessly. And it doesn't have this key property of monotonically growing d. D is a conserved quantity for this Hamiltonian. Now, this other Hamiltonian is basically, apart from the logarithm, but when d is equal to zero, they coincide. So for small intervals of your independent parameter, while d doesn't change much, they generate similar curves on shape space. They are close to those geodesics. Over over long distances, though, they diverge. This other Hamiltonian its curves are very different, and they show this irreversibility that I will introduce now. Now, these are the equations of motion generated by the this Hamiltonian here. And as you can see, they depend on the shape momenta. D is your independent variable, and they are non-autonomous. They depend on D appears on the right-hand side of the equations. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not exactly what we want. The description we wanted was, 5 minutes, okay, should have been something that does not depend on anything that is dimensionful, because shape space is dimensionless, but at this stage, the shape momenta are dimensionful because you see from this relation, the Poisson brackets are dimensionful. Theta, the sigma, so the theta and phi are dimensionless angles. So pi have to be dimensionful, and as well, and also D has to be dimensionful. From the Hamiltonian constraint, you see that they have the same dimensions. So, in particular, we can express everything in dimensions of length. They are all length to the 1/2. So we have an independent parameter that is dimensionful and momenta that are dimensionful. We want to remove this defect. We want to describe everything intrinsically on shape space. What we did was this, to observe that there is a unique transformation we can perform to go to dimensionless momenta by dividing them by D, the independent variable, and also taking the logarithm of D over this reference value, which is unphysical, it's just a convention, to obtain this dimensionless evolution parameter lambda. Now, this transformation gives you a system which is purely in terms of dimensionless things. And the new equations of motion are this. You see that the D squared that was here disappeared. And everything is, now the equations of motion are autonomous. They do not depend on your independent parameter on the right-hand side. They only depend through its the derivative with respect to it here. But they have this characteristic. They're not Hamiltonian because the transformation we did was not a canonical transformation. We divided by the independent parameter here. So the resulting equations cannot be derived from an Hamiltonian. They are not canonical. They are in particular dissipative. This term here dissipates your momentum, or your shape kinetic energy as you progress the evolution. Now, these equations lead to this sort of behavior on shape space. This is the same curve associated to this solution of the three-body problem, as seen from shape space. As you can see, it is very different from what you would have expected from a geodesic principle on shape space. It divides into two branches, which both of them exhibit an irreversible behavior. They tend to fall down into the potential wells, and because they lose kinetic energy, and therefore they fall down. The whole story, the combination of the two branches, would be time reversal invariant, because Newton's equations are time reversal invariant. But according to our hypothesis that is justified by the growth of irreversible behavior, if your past is this, and your future is defined by where your orbit is more your final shape is more complex, those are your two futures. And those are two different histories of the universe with one past and one future. If you cut it out there, where D is equal to zero in particular, you see no trace of time reversal invariance. It was really, from the shape space perspective, and something pretty artificial introduced by the fact that you were joining together two different solutions. Now, 2 minutes. Oh, okay. This is the picture that Julian showed you before. And you see that CS can be bounded from below by a function that is growing monotonically. And the oscillations are due to the two-body Kepler orbits. This behavior becomes more like that for the case of 1,000 particles. This is a plot made numerically by Jerome Barclay, our collaborator. Here you see that all the oscillations due to the different Kepler pairs will average out, and the mean behavior would be something like that. Small oscillations around the linear growth of this complexity. Now, this, I guess this should be my final slide. I don't have time to show you much more, but this is the broad picture for the history of the universe that we are getting to. This is a representation, a schematic representation of shape space for the generic n-body. We cannot represent it in 2D, but it gives you the idea that there is a distinguished point, a single distinguished point, which corresponds to the most uniform shape. Julian likes to call it alpha. And then all the other shapes are distinguished by the growing value of this unbounded complexity function that we have in shape space. The generic solution, all solutions are like that apart from a measure zero set. In Newtonian time, they will come from a very far. They will get very close to alpha. They're bonded to do like that because of these equations. Well, the fact that D is monotonic and I is U-shaped, so I is always shrinking here and growing there. So they will get very close to alpha, and then they will depart and fly away in another direction. The arrow time we are proposing here points from the place where D is equal to zero, which is the least complex, one of the least complex shapes that the system encounters, towards the two branches. So you have two, again, like in Boltzmann's case, you have a one past to future scenario. What you will find when you're looking here at this stage of the evolution of the universe is something like that, a blob, which is very homogeneous. If you put yourself in the place of one particle, you will see a distribution of a particle that is pretty homogeneous. If you go here towards the later stages, you find these sort of things. The formation of a large number of subsystems that are bound, they cluster together, and they fly apart from each other, so they get more and more isolated and separated. These things here, this is just a shape, there is no notion of scale, but it has spontaneously produced through the evolution, some notions of rods and clocks. These things have a size with respect to the other pairs, and they can be used as measuring rods from for each other. And since they become more and more isolated, they also become more and more mutually congruent. Also, their period, for the same reason that they're becoming isolated, becomes isochronous, one with respect to each other. So the form of the dynamics on shape space is tuned so that you create a large number of measuring rods and clocks at the end of the universe, of the history of the universe. And you tend spontaneously towards more complex configurations and less homogeneous ones. And I think I have to stop here because otherwise we won't have time for any question. But this is going towards trying to explain what we see in our universe, which is something that is very, you know, long, enormous void spaces with clumps of matter that are very tightly bound, while in the past we had a very uniform state. So, if you have any question? Yeah?
So, isn't there a danger that this picture is going to break down as soon as you put in general relativity, because there, when your particles approach close enough together, they're liable to form black holes and not come apart again.
We didn't think about the formation of black holes, which would be very interesting to put in the future. But we have started studying the generalization of this to GR. Problem is that you have to have a description of shape space for GR. We started with toy models. The simplest example is Bianchi 9, which has two shapes, degrees of freedom, so you can actually form a curve on shape space. There are several differences, and they all conspire together, at least in that case, to give you a monotonically growing notion of complexity or inhomogeneity of your shape. That's all we can say for now. I'm not sure about the creation of black holes, because we have considered only pure gravity, no matter. And I don't know if you have anything to add about holes.
I would only say, Steve, that this is very early. It's just the first hint that.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
That there. And there's a. When you get to GR, we've done Bianchi 9. No matter. Matter's going to make a huge difference. One observation I would make about the black holes is that I understand actually that in the shape dynamics, I think, really fits best for a spatially closed universe where actually not all that much is known about black holes, really, when you get down to it. I mean, that there are concentrations of matter in the universe in an incredibly small region, that's beyond doubt. But exactly what's going on down there, I think, is the answer we don't really know.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that the black hole can't be considered a rod anyway. Maybe that is to be seen. So, any other question?
I was wondering, the dissipative equation that you wrote down, is there a sense in which it's unique, or is, can you show that there are no non-dissipative evolution equations?
It's uniquely determined by the conspiring of two things that I wanted, the dimensionless momenta and autonomous equation. The two things together uniquely determine the transformation that you have to make to obtain this. I could have, you know, to make this dimensionless, I could have used the square root of the moment of inertia, but there's no way in which the equation could have been autonomous in that case. This is sort of speech though. Chair, what should we do?
Another question there.
Other questions?
I think there was, wasn't there?
Okay. We switched roles.
Yes. Thank you anyway.
Yeah, I was already mentally preparing to talk myself.
Yeah, that is fair enough. So we now have Tim Kozlowski giving us the review talk on shape dynamics and full screen mode, I guess.
It's not exactly a review talk since we had plenary talk. I gave a review on shape dynamics. I will expand on some of the things that were said in Enrique's plenary talk and also use some of the ideas that were that Julian and Flavio just introduced in the talk that just preceded. So you might wonder what that. Why I put that picture there. This is a rock with funny shape, an interesting shape, close to where I grew up. And there are two contradictory legends about that rock, where these holes come from. One is that they're due to a pagan ritual, a pagan sacrifice ritual, and that's what they were used for. The other one is that it was a saint, the Saint Kunigunde, that's why it's called Kunigundenstein, who prayed there, and those were her knees left those indentations and her elbows left those. So there's two legends that contradict one another. And
so
the reason I put.
Why do they contradict each other?
They do contradict each other.
Why? Not really.
If they were due to a saint kneeling there, then they should not have been there in pre-Christian times where it was due to that. So the origin of those holes, I mean, historically it was actually, history actually proved that it was a sacrifice site for some pre-Christian culture that was there. The reason I put that in is because, as Nick explained in his talk this morning, there are at least two explanations of classical gravity. One is the space-time geometry that solves Einstein's equations, and the other is evolving spatial conformal geometry. And it's, of course, the second description that I want to emphasize, and I want to talk about what possible differences come about if you believe the second legend to be more fundamental than the first. So that's what I'm going to do. So if general relativity explains gravity as a space-time geometry, and the reason we use space-time to conceptualize is because the space-time ties all these foliations together. Naturally, if you think about gravity as a dynamical system, you would think about a succession of spatial geometries that interact with matter. But due to refoliation invariance, these successions of spatial geometries lead, so this is here conformal, this is here superspace, so the space of all three geometries, modular diffeomorphisms. The succession depends on which foliation I choose here. So I've just indicated this with two, with the red and the blue, and the red and the blue curve in superspace. Of course, there's an infinite number. And if I have this sheaf of curves in superspace, there is no known way to get rid of this redundancy in superspace. But with just adding a few props to this curve in superspace, to this succession of three geometries, namely the labs here, we get a very simple geometric object, space-time geometry, that ties all these foliations together and gives a very simple explanation for gravity. And this is why it's so convenient to conceptualize about gravity in terms of space-time geometry. Now I should have said, if you wanted to look at the dynamical problem, you will soon get desperate and you would try to fix the gauge and get really frustrated with the system. And for me, one of the first things when I started to work on shape dynamics was almost a miracle that the York procedure worked. This is also what Enrique stressed in his talk this morning. This is that the complicated dynamics, so that the complicated sheaf of curves here, that there is one particular representative that projects down to a curve on conformal superspace, and that is actually a well-defined dynamical system just on conformal superspace. And that requires a number of results. It requires the conformal invariance of the spin decomposition that you have, that you can solve the ADM momentum constraints through the spin decomposition, and that you can solve the ADM scalar constraints just by uniquely by choosing a conformal factor. These results all go into this miracle that there is a unique representative that projects down to a curve on conformal superspace. And so the first explanation gravity in terms of shape dynamics is gravity is evolving spatial conformal geometry. But in this first box, I just put in that. The takeaway message from this morning that you have ADM phase space with diffeomorphism and local Weyl constraints and a complicated Hamiltonian as the definition of a gravity theory in that sort. But from the previous talk, from what Julian and Flavia were telling you, you can make use of this dynamical similarity. So now what happens is this Hamiltonian here depends on the time parameter. The analog of this d in the particle model, the dilatational momentum, is York time in gravity, which is the trace of the extrinsic curvature, essentially. And the conformal degrees of freedom, so the conformal metric rho and the trace free the trace free part of the momenta, metric momenta. And simply due to dimensional analysis that the Hamiltonian has a homogeneous dimension, the conformal metric is dimensionless, you can use a similar dynamical similarity as in the particle model, pull out York time, and always set this York time to a reference value. I mean, I just call it one. It's just an arbitrary reference value that I set there at the expense of rescaling the momenta. Now, in the particle model, you saw that you divided the momenta by d. Here in this case, to make the momenta dimensionless, you multiply them with the square of your octave, that's just the dimension. So my rescaled, the sigma tilde is the rescaled momenta by this tau squared times the original trace free metric momenta. And then I make the Poisson bracket dimensionless just with the same trick. I pull out the factor of York time. And then I have done a similar non-canonical transformation in gravity that Julien and Flavio have presented for the embodied problem. And I get an autonomous evolution. So in this time, that is, if I don't have a cosmological constant, it's just the log of York time. This has a Hamiltonian part with this Hamiltonian, and it has a dissipative part, which is just due to this rescaling of the momenta. Something is shrinking from the projector. And of course, if you have dissipation, you have a notion of a bulk entropy that comes into that. I won't talk about that much more in this talk, except for one remark at the end. So a more refined version of what shape dynamics tells us about gravity, so the second legend of what gravity is that gravity is a dissipative evolution of spatial conformal geometry. So all dimensionless, so you strip everything of conventional units, and the objective description is just a dissipative evolution of spatial conformal geometry. So now, as was stressed this morning, the shape dynamics and GR are locally equivalent, but that doesn't imply global equivalence. Let's look at that, what we have and what we need. So the equations of motion for general relativity and shape dynamics coincide when, on the one hand, GR is evolved in CMC gauge. That means I have to choose the foliation where the trace of the extrinsic curvature is a spatial constant. And I have to choose a lapse that is determined by an elliptic equation. And that coincides, this system coincides with the evolution of shape dynamics if I impose a gauge condition that is determined by the Lichtenherz-York equation, right? That I'm maintaining the Lichtenherz-York equation. So, but this local equivalence breaks down whenever any of these three ingredients here breaks down. So, if CMC gauge is not available, if a CMC lapse is not available, or if a solution to the Lichtenherz-York equation is not available. So Julien had told me in a phone conversation about a year ago, or maybe half a year, a while ago, he said, those are just the props that hold up space-time. The evolution of gravity is really autonomous dissipative evolution of conformal geometry. And I called it embellishments, and he didn't like that. He said, no, this is just you just need this prop, you just need this N, you just need this conformal factor here that hold up space-time and in fact, if I go back here, what I would really have liked in this picture was to have some props here and call them N and have some arches over here that spread out the hypersurface geometry and call them phi, the conformal factor that gives it size in space-time. But I'm not very good at drawing pictures. That has to wait for the next conference. So if I tell you that gravity is about evolution of a spatial conformal geometry, then I ask a very different question than, because I don't care whether those props that hold up space-time actually exist. So as Enrique stressed in his talk this morning, CMC slices avoid many singularities, and maximum slices avoid all time-like singularities. So there is a possible generic. So this part of the condition for equivalence breaks down for a large class of singularities that we know, and particularly those that we know from many of those that we know from singularity theorems. So the possible global differences are important precisely in those cases. So what I should do from the perspective, if I believe in the shape dynamics story about gravity, is just to look at the curve on just at the evolution of spatial conformal geometry, where the, and if I have matter, also of the matter degrees of freedom, whether I can extend that curve, and I don't have to care whether I can choose a non-zero conformal factor, positive flaps, or whether I can embed it into a space-time at all, this constant trace of the extrinsic curvature. So to give you one simple example where a difference happens is, I actually learned that from Carlip's book in 2 plus 1, also from the Living Review. I take a Bianchi 1 cosmology on a 3 torus, or a 2 plus 1 torus. Then the CMC Hamiltonian is just the geodesic Hamiltonian on this Teichmuller space, on this space of trajectories. So if I have a positive cosmological constant, then a generic solution looks like I have a big bang somewhere, I have some rapid change of shape of the torus, and then after some time, the system just starts to expand homothetically, but that won't change its shape anymore, it freezes out. So how is that possible if the CMC Hamiltonian is really just the geodesic Hamiltonian? Well, you look at this and you see, oh, it's just two of those props break down. The Big Bang is really that to solve the zero-zero component of Einstein's equations, I have to choose a conformal factor that goes to zero after a finite time. But still, the shape evolution, if I look at this Hamiltonian, is just this evolution goes through this point without feeling anything that's rough to it. And the same thing about the asymptotic freeze out. This is just you have to the other prop breaks down. It's just you have to choose a lapse that diverges after a finite amount of York time, but this evolution, the curve on shape space can naturally extend beyond that point. So from the point of view of any clock that I've defined, that I construct from within the system, there is no proper time. This system would just evolve beyond this asymptotic freeze out, and I would just continue on this curve and on Teichmuller space if I believe in the shape dynamics ontology of gravity. So now I told you that gravity in D plus one dimensions is the evolution of a d-dimensional conformal theory. And that really, as Enrique also said in his talk this morning, is very much like a bulk version of ADS-CFT. So it's very tempting to explain aspects of ADS-CFT with that, and there is actually a nice thing. So let me first say what I want to explain. I won't explain there is a more subtle argument about holographic renormalization, and I can save that for the question afterwards. What is simple to explain is why at the classical level you expect conformal symmetry near the boundary. And that is due to you can call it special CMC slices. So those are slices that have constant trace of extrinsic curvature, but the intrinsic Ricci scalar is also a spatial constant. If you're in one of these slices, then the proper time evolution in that slice coincides with the shape dynamics evolution because it's the CMC evolution. This is the CMC lapse in that case. So in that case, because we now know this is just the point where the equations of motion are manifest in the shape dynamics equation, when you can check that propagates the conformal constraints of shape dynamics as gauge generators through when you go through this slice with proper time. So now you look at what the boundary conditions that you impose in asymptotically ADS, asymptotically locally ADS, so just have a conformally compact Euclidean solution to Einstein's equations. And you look at these equations, you look at these boundary conditions, they imply that the constant radial slices become a constant mean curvature when you approach the boundary, and that the intrinsic Ricci scalar becomes constant as you approach. It becomes more homogeneous as you approach the boundary. It's exactly homogeneous at the boundary. So the boundary is one of these special CMC slices. So now the radial evolution is just the shape dynamics evolution, and this, so the boundary CFT, this evolution is just the restriction of shape dynamics to the boundary, and this explains the propagation of the conformal constraint at the boundary, not in the bike. From shape dynamics, you would expect it in the bike, but it's no longer radial evolution in the bike, it's CMC evolution. You have to choose a very different lapse in the bike to do that. You can actually do a little more. You can play a little bit of this holographic renormalization group game, and you can reproduce some of these results that were obtained by Skinderis and Yaro, and I forget all the names that are involved in that. So I have 5 minutes. So I will probably just go over this point here. So Enrique gave this morning a classical argument for why how shape dynamics could be constructed by this requirement that you're able to do symmetry trading on the ADM phase space, and that you have. He made some assumptions about even and so on. I want to give a slightly different version, an argument that is not based on the ability of doing symmetry trading, but it's on the requirement that I have that I want to write a pass integral for a spatial diffuse, and actually that's what I write in brackets means I have I want to write the delta for the constraint, the delta for the gauge fixing, and the for the Popov determinant. That's what is indicated by this bracket here. So I suppose I can do that, and I can. This is harmless. Now, if I also suppose what shape dynamics tells me is that I have volume preserving conformal transformations, which is the we didn't stress it in these talks very much. In previous versions, if you have attended any of those talks, we stressed very much that in order to get York scaling, you needed to take on a compact manifold, you needed to take out the overall volume of the from the spatial Y transformations and treat that separately. Now, if I do that, and then I just write a canonical path integral with a gauge fixing condition. So I just write an arbitrary gauge fixing condition, H, and I want it to be. I do just what you would do in Wilsonian renormalization. You would say, I want it to be local, I want it to be even, I want it to be power counting relevant. So I write this, and then I can just write down a few number of terms because of that. They're essentially the terms that appear in the ADM Hamilton constraints. But now, of course, each term appears with its own coupling constant. So now, But now I can, one observation that everyone would make immediately is that this B here, because that's what's in front of the spatial derivatives. But that is just the definition of the speed of light. So that that is not an actual coupling constant of the theory. And then what is more surprising is that this C here, that gave people a lot of headache in Hochschauer-Lifshitz gravity, can be removed by this dynamical similarity that I had here. If this was for gravity without cosmological constant, if I have a cosmological constant here, I have to also rescale it with the appropriate power of York time, because this is dimensional analysis that allows me to do that. And that allows me to remove this C here. So if I then look at those coupling constants that can be distinguished from the curve from classical shape space, then I see that this is a classical conformal superspace. I see that that it just has this coupling A here, which is essentially Newton's constant, and this coupling constant B here, which is essentially the cosmological constant. So shape dynamics, as in theory equivalent to GR, arises naturally as a low energy limit if this ansatz for a pass integral is correct. I mean, there are of course a lot of things. So since I have only 1 minute, I will conclude. I want to repeat some of the features of shape dynamics. So we explain gravity as a dissipative evolution of spatial conformal geometry, and we, for a long time, we have stressed that it's locally indistinguishable from general relativity. But with this Bianchi 1 example that I gave you, there is a more complicated argument that you have to make for Bianchi 9. And I'm not completely sure that's why it's not in here, about one detail of that. Evolution can be extended to some classical space-time singularities. I showed that it explains a classical aspect of ADS-CFT. I claim that that you can also match some calculations, and that it emerges at a low energy limit of this BPCT invariant pass integral. And what I didn't get to is that it opens some new ideas about quantum gravity in particular. There is a heuristic way to loop quantize the system. There are open problems with how to formulate the dynamics in that, but one has access to the physical Hilbert space in that case. And there are also hints that this bulk entropy and this extension of curves on conformal superspace, that black hole entropy is entirely due to entanglement in the matter sector. But those are preliminary hints, and I would have to show you the entire argument. So don't take this face while you ask me questions if you're interested. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
So I want to understand this thing that you said about ADS-CFT. So you're talking about the pure vacuum. You don't have any matter fields.
No, right now, in for this calculation, it is pure gravity. So it is really this system that, for example, Skinderis et al. Looked at. And
so how would it change if I put, let's say, a field in the background? Because I need to evaluate the on-shell action.
Yes. We have done one calculation in that, and with a scalar field, and there it looks like there is no at the conformal boundary there is no difference from the usual holographic renormalization.
So you have still to regularize the space.
Yes.
The space is infinite.
Yes. So. Yes, exactly. The dictionary I'm just doing very simple things. I identify the Hamilton-Jacobi function of this theory, so the on-shell action, with the with the effective action of the QFT at a particular scale. So I imagine that is an IR suppression term, that it suppresses all modes that below some scale. And then I identify the divergent terms and the finite terms of this in the volume expansion. When you go to the boundary, because the spatial volume will diverge in the Euclidean case, I identify those with counted, the divergent terms with counted terms. The finite terms, you have to extract the anomaly from that. And that's what, so it is really just doing that. It's not doing anything.
Well, what else? It's giving you something extra, because you have, you know, you have this conformal factor of the group. You know, that
yes, so
else.
it actually gives us, for ADS CFT, it's actually giving us a kind of an embarrassment. Because because if you look at the space once you impose the boundary conditions, I didn't write them down explicitly, but you look at the when you look at an asymptotically ADS, asymptotically locally ADS space time, then I say we have spatial conformal invariance. The counter terms are not Weyl invariant, but if you impose the boundary conditions, then there are not enough metrics to distinguish this functional from a Weyl invariant functional that just coincides precisely for metrics that satisfy these boundary conditions. That's what we get more, but it's kind of an embarrassment because you get all this non-locality due to the to conformal invariance.
I think we have to thank
Okay, can you hear me? Excellent. Thanks a lot to the organizers and to Flavio in particular for inviting me into this session. This is a joint work with Sean, and I'll proceed fairly quickly. So the overall plan is I'm going to start with three kind of basic lessons I think we've learned about ADMGL, which I don't think will be so controversial to most of us anyway. And then proceed to talk some kind of quite general and perhaps slightly philosophical ideas about variational principles and degrees of freedom, and talk about the case of gravity a little bit. And then I'll push into our kind of proposal for how we should think about symmetry and evolution in quantum gravity. So the first lesson is something I think was featured in Enrique's talk this morning, that Hamiltonian constraints are not pure gauge generators. So we know from the structure of this Dirac-Bergmann algebra, particularly this equation 3, that there's some kind of partially dynamical role. And we certainly can't isolate the action of Hamiltonian on the ADM phase space as a gauge generator in anything like the normal sense. So that's the first lesson. The second lesson really comes from thinking about the way the observables function and about how we construct the reduced phase space and functions on that. And so I'll just take this as a quote from Moncrief. So one often hears of the desirability of constructing a complete set of observables for the gravitational field, i.e. a maximal independent set of functions of the ADM canonical variables, which Poisson commute with all the constraints. However, such observables by themselves merely provide an ambiguous set of labels for spacetimes in question, and do not yield without further information the geometrical properties of these spacetimes. In this respect, they're somewhat analogous to the complete set of initial positions and momenta that label the solutions of any problem in Hamiltonian mechanics. And this is really something you can see quite clearly geometrically by thinking about the way that the symplectic reduction of the orbits of the Hamiltonian constraints project would bring you down to reduced phase space, where the points really do just label label Einstein spacetimes. And so the third lesson is that the positivity of the lapse encodes ordering structure. So in the construction of the ADM, of ADMGR, either from a Lagrangian approach or by the Ojman-Kukash and Teitelboom argument, the lapse multiplier associated with the Hamiltonian constraint is fixed to be positive definite. And so this implies the existence of a local monotonically increasing time parameter within any foliation. So although the theory is refoliation invariant, there still exists fundamental time ordering structure implicitly within the theory. So based upon these three lessons, let's then think a bit about how we can think about variational principles and how we think about symmetry. And we'll go back to GR and then mix the lessons together with our ideas about how to think about symmetry to motivate a slightly different way of doing quantization. So symmetry generally is associated with some form of redundancy occurring between in the relationship between our mathematical formalism on the one hand and the characteristic behavior of the system to which it corresponds. So the actual kind of way that the physics of the system, its degrees of freedom, and its the kind of physical boundary conditions which are characteristic of it, corresponds to our formalism. It's really how we should understand the origin of symmetries, and the exact nature of this relationship should allow us to classify symmetries in a particular way. And so if the action doesn't change when the sample paths are varied globally with respect to a function, then this automatically implies a symmetry. And we're going to call that kind of symmetry a manifest symmetry. And the other option is that there's no symmetry, or that there's a hidden symmetry. We've heard a bit about hidden symmetries already in Enrique's talk. And hidden symmetries are important in GR, and we'll talk about that in the context of symmetry trading a little bit later. So given we have this one distinction between manifest and hidden symmetries, we also have a distinction between free and fixed variations. So if the variational principle is one in which no conditions are imposed on a degree of freedom, we say it's a free variation. Otherwise, we say it's a fixed variation. And so here we're actually considering, this is actually an idea due to Julian, we're thinking about variation of the action based upon space-based curve and direction of a particular degree of freedom. But our focus is on the endpoints. So it's actually on the endpoint variation, which roughly speaking corresponds to considering slightly adjusted variational principles defined by action principles with slightly different, infinitesimally different boundary conditions. And so given these two distinctions between manifest and non-manifest and fixed and free, we can make a kind of categorization scheme. So manifest symmetry is associated with fixed variations we're going to call conservation symmetries. And this recovers, to a large extent, the Noether symmetries plus a little bit more. And then manifest symmetries associated with free variations we're going to call gauge symmetries. And again, this recovers most of what was traditionally called gauge symmetries, but with a little bit less, in fact. And there are key interpretational differences between the two, which we'll talk about briefly. We'll talk about shortly. And so as we've seen from the very first slide, the structure of the Dirac-Bergmann algebra implies that for the case of ADMGR, the symmetry and dynamics are deeply entangled. I really like that quote. And so in our terminology, we can re-describe this entangling of symmetry dynamics in terms of the fixed and free aspects of the manifest symmetry being mixed together. And so we can address this problem using the idea of symmetry trading, which we've already heard quite a lot about. And so we had an identification of the hidden symmetries within ADMGR allows us to trade the complicated Dirac-Bergmann algebra, which isn't a Lie algebra, for a simpler yet under certain restrictions equivalent algebra, which is very closely related to the shape dynamics constraint algebra, which is a Lie algebra. And so in general, we have this notion of hidden symmetry occurring when there's no manifest symmetry, the variation is free, and there's another manifest symmetry in the theory which is second class with respect to this one. And so if this is the case, the Hamiltonian can be modified without changing the physical prediction of the theory in such a way that the symmetry becomes manifest. And so this is one of the key ideas, one of the key ingredients in our proposal, which really comes out of the shape dynamics work that many of the people here are responsible for. Okay, so let's think about, I said before that part of the prescription is that we have to identify for the system in question what we take to be the characteristic behavior, the fundamental physical degrees of freedom, and the way in which the action principle implements the physical variation or the physical characteristics of the system. So following York's proposal, we can treat the physical degrees of freedom of gravity as a three geometry invariant under conformal and diffeomorphism symmetry is one of the degrees, and also the mean of the York time variable, which is canonically conjugate to the spatial volume. And we take these variables to faithfully parameterize the characteristic behavior of gravity. And we take their variation, because of this, we should take their variation to be of the fixed kind, whilst variation of all the other variables should be free. So it's a particular prescription for what are the physical degrees of freedom, which we're characterizing in variational terms. And so from your perspective, the ADM action has the rather undesirable feature of neither having manifest invariance under volume-preserving conformal transformations, nor being a conventional gauge theory with respect to diffeomorphisms, nor varying the York time in a fixed manner. And so the first two difficulties can be resolved by noting that the volume-preserving conformal strengths are a hidden symmetry of the ADM action, a la shape dynamics. But it's the last difficulty that we really want to focus on, that we have a proposal dealing with it based on something we call relational quantization. So it's a way of allowing the York time in a reformulation of gravity to become something which can vary as a fundamental degree of freedom in this fixed variation manner. And so in a kind of incoherence with what I've been saying about classical symmetries and classical degrees of freedom, really the physical basis of a symmetry is what should dictate its treatment within a faithful quantization procedure. It shouldn't just be about identifying a purely mathematical prescription of how to quantize a symmetry or degree of freedom. It should really be about retaining the degrees of freedom and the description of the characteristic behavior of the system throughout quantization. And so we should tailor our quantization techniques to our actual physical understanding of the symmetries and degrees of freedom in question. And gauge symmetries result from surplus representational structure. And so the degrees of freedom to which they correspond must be eliminated at some stage within the construction of the physical Hilbert space. And this is a completely conventional notion, albeit in our context with gauge symmetries not merely classified based upon local symmetry group actions or first class constraints, but on the basis of free variations with manifest symmetry. Conservation symmetries, on the other hand, reflect the existence of conserved charges and not redundant variables. So quantization should preserve the numbers of degrees of freedom and allow for superpositions of the relevant conserved charges. And so based on this, we can actually make a quite general prescription for starting with a system with a certain symmetries, making identifications, and going through a procedure which is somewhat circuitous, but leads us to quite a consistent and multiply applicable schema for quantization. So first we determine whether there exists a manifest symmetry associated with a particular degree of freedom. Then, given an identification of the characteristic behavior of the system, such as the York identification, gravity, determine the nature of the variational principle, fixed or free, to be applied to the degree of freedom in question. Then perform a Legendre transformation. Extend the phase space by augmenting it with these auxiliary canonical variables that parameterize the symmetry and add the appropriate constraints to preserve the relevant physics. We then determine the canonical transformation of the variables and constraints that isolates the degree of freedom in question. And then we make this choice. We have a bifurcation. If the degree of freedom is associated with a fixed variation, we proceed directly to Dirac quantization. So we've introduced two variables, then we take out two variables. So we end up with the same number we started off with. On the other hand, if the degree of freedom is associated with a free variation, we add an additional constraint and then proceed to Dirac quantization. So as in the conventional kind of treatment of quantization of symmetries, we end up losing two variables per constraint. So in total, we'd have two constraints, so we end up losing four variables. Which gets us, we add in two, take away four, and we end up exactly where we would be in a conventional treatment. And so this is all kind of, the whole kind of idea behind this reclassification of symmetries is to think about reparameterization symmetry in a different way to as conventionally treated. So if we think about a finite dimensional Jacobi type model, the reparameterizations would induce a mapping between different parameterizations of the same configuration space curve, the same curve. And we can straightforwardly show that this is a symmetry of the action, and if we move to phase-based formalism, it implies the existence of a first-class constraint, which would usually, in kind of Dirac terms, imply it was a gauge symmetry. However, The variational principle we have on phase space is, like that on configuration space, already well-defined. All the directions are parameterized by degrees of freedom with a direct correspondence to the characteristic behavior of the system, at least under identification. So according to our scheme, reparameterization, or global reparameterization at the very least, is a conservation symmetry and not a gauge symmetry. And that's the key kind of classificatory difference between what we're proposing and most conventional approaches. And so given this reclassification and given our scheme for quantization, we proceed slightly differently. So we, from the finite dimensional reparameterization model, given the identification of the symmetry as a fixed variation, so a conservation symmetry, we'd make this arbitrary phase-based extension by two variables because you've got a one-dimensional symmetry group. And we've labeled the single auxiliary configuration variable tau and its momenta pi. And so the Hamiltonian of the extended system can be written as this extended constraint here. Our extended theory now has two extra degrees of freedom. We interpret tau as an arbitrary label for change-long trajectories in the original phase space, and pi as a conserved charge. And now if we apply standard Dirac quantization, we arrive at a quantum theory with precisely the number of degrees of freedom we start off with on phase space. We haven't lost any, we've added into and taken away to. And we get a different kind of quantum formalism. It isn't the Wheeler-DeWitt quantization of this model, which has been proposed by many people. It's a slightly different quantization, which York and Brown actually did, I think, in the 80s. And so given this, we actually have an analogous prescription for the quantization of gravity. So we start with the ADM variables and the constraint algebra, and using a combination of arbitrary extension and symmetry trading, move to a new theory, which has the following system of constraints. A single Hamiltonian constraint, which is an extended York Hamiltonian, because it has an extra piece in it, and which is responsible for global reparameterizations. Transform momentum constraints, which are completely analogous to those of shape dynamics, responsible for spatial diffeomorphisms. And then the following pair, volume-preserving conformal constraints, responsible for the free variation of the conformal factor of the metric. And then a single constraint, which is responsible for fixing the value of the York type. And so based upon our prescription for relational quantization, we should remove this final constraint so that the York time variation becomes fixed rather than free, and then apply a canonical quantization, which gives us a quantum formalism where we have extended York Hamiltonian as a constraint on the wave function, not the simple York Hamiltonian as you would in a Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. And so this is my final slide. There's these following kind of interpretational and formal differences between what we're proposing in a conventional Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. So in Wheeler-DeWitt quantization, only one energy eigenvalue is allowed, and evolution of the quantum states can be obtained by deparameterizing respect to a degree of freedom that one must make an arbitrary decision and a choice of. And the observables can lead to, depending on this choice, and even for simple models can be very complicated. And for relational quantization, we can have superpositions of energy eigenstates and describe evolution of the full state respect to this auxiliary label. And the identification of the observables is easier because of the time dependence of the Hamiltonian. And furthermore, unlike in the Wheeler-DeWitt approach, just going back to my third lesson, under the relational quantization, we have ordering structure that from the classical formalism retained. And what we're thinking about at the moment is trying to apply the model to early universe cosmology and see if we can find distinct predictions, at least for the mini superspace model. Thanks a lot.
Time for a couple of questions.
I guess I'm confused at a very early level about our distinction between gauge symmetries and conservation symmetries. In electromagnetism, what symmetry is responsible for the existence of the conserved electric charge? Is that not a gauge symmetry in your classification?
The constraints in, at least for the canonical formalism of electromagnetism, we wouldn't treat any differently to the Dirac treatment, certainly. So we'd treat the actual the gauge orbits as general, genuine, kind of unphysical directions. But I'm not quite sure about it. that answers your question.
No, I mean,
well, it's so just, I'm confused about your use of conserved charges and the word conservation there, because in electromagnetism, it is the gauge symmetry that leads to the conserved charge.
Yeah. I mean, you still have a Gauss constraint. And when you add matter, then the Gauss constraint slips into the matter piece and the electromagnetic field piece.
Yeah.
And that's what you call a conserved charge. So we were thinking so in that case, you get what you call a conserved charge, but it's related to the gauge symmetry. So maybe we should.
Okay, so maybe it's a terminology problem.
Yeah, it's just a terminology problem. Let me put it a different way. It should be, you have to kind of, in our way of thinking about it, you have to study each system on its own. What is, we use the word characteristic behavior of the system. And then once you determine the things you can measure and the things that are real and the things that are a result of the formalism, then you can decide what parameters you have to input into your variational principle, what parameters you're allowed to fix, and what parameters are just gauge things. And so that's the sense in which it's sort of case-to-case basis. You have to look at this thing and say, this degree of freedom is very fixed, and this one is free.
This can be spot.
Yeah.
Later discussion. We have another question.
Yeah, maybe I may correct me if I'm wrong. I want to, the question is the following statement correct? You want to be able to specify classically the difference of your time between the initial and final state. And that's the difference, I think, between electromagnetism. You don't want to specify a particular gauge in the initial and final state. You don't look at the evolution of that part, but in what John Karim are trying to do is from the variational principle, which you can specify your definition and your time file, and they want to retain that in, throughout the form. Is this?
Yeah, that sounds.
Right, maybe if it's quick.
So when you're talking about conventional Willard-DeWitt quantization, right, you say that you might try to deparameterize some degree of freedom in order to get a clock, essentially.
Mm.
But, and you say that it's sort of arbitrary, but it seems to me that, isn't it arbitrary that you chose to use the York ontology? I mean, I could have chose a different ontology, and it seems to me that choosing the York ontology is doing exactly the same thing for you as deparameterizing something to serve as a clock in Willard-DeWitt.
I'm not sure that's quite correct. I think doing, like, choosing something internally as a clock, you're also choosing an ontology, and then you're using part of that ontology as a clock. So I think you end up making two choices rather than. So the idea is you have a theory and you pick the gauge invariant degrees of freedom, and then you can quantize it without having to choose an internal clock as well. And I think there's a distinction between the two steps. I'm not saying that the ontology we're saying is the only possible way of characterizing gravity, but I think it's got some advantages, particularly from like numerical relativity.
All right, probably we should go the next step now to get Stadio in London. About models for gravity and the problem of time.
Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah. So it's a pleasure for me to be able to tell you about the work that I did for my master thesis with Flavio Mercati and Giulia Barbo, based on a conjecture by Sean Gray. And I think that the basic idea is really about looking at all the issues in gravity, but taking this, the point of view or the approach of shape dynamics. And we are going, I'm going to do that in a particle analog model, because it's simple, so all the mathematics of the quantization is really under control. And we can see if, at least in a toy model, we can get new physical insights from the shape dynamics approach. So the plan of my talk is to tell you about how to construct this analog model, this particle analog model, in such a way that I will make clear, capture some of the relational features of general relativity. And then I'll try to use it to address some of the old issues in gravity, like the problem of time and the lack of full-scale invariance. So let's make a bit more precise what I mean by building a relational model. I'll call a time relational model a theory which is invariant under time reparametrization, which is based on an action principle, which is a Jacobi-type action principle, and which has an invariance under arbitrary time reparametrization. So a couple of examples of that is just the Jacobi action in classical mechanics, or the Baylor-Sharpe-Wheeler action in general relativity. And it's interesting to observe that any model which is time relational in this definition is going to present under naive quantization a problem of time. This is clear because if you have this symmetry, this invariance under time reparametrization, arbitrary time reparametrization, then your momenta are not independent. There is an algebraic equation between the momenta. That algebraic equation is just the Hamiltonian constraint. When you quantize it, you get something that looks like a time-independent Schrödinger equation or a Wheeler-Witt equation in gravity. So a very interesting question, and a long-standing question, is how we recover a well-defined notion of time evolution in such a context. And something that is really interesting for me is also about this idea of symmetry trading and the possibility of trading refoliation invariance in GR for invariance under the conformal group in shape dynamics. But it's what is really interesting, I think, is that the trading is not complete. You cannot really trade the whole conformal group, but you can trade refoliation invariance for volume preserving conformal transformations. And it's a kind of it's strange but interesting that there is this single global degrees of freedom that looks like it's on gauge, it's physical. That degrees of freedom is the volume of the universe. That is something that you wouldn't expect from a relational model. So another interesting question is why gravity is not fully scale invariant from this point of view. And so the conjecture on which this work is based is that gravity is actually truly scale invariant, but that something that has to do with quantum mechanics is breaking the full symmetry. It singles out this single global degrees of freedom. And the other conjecture is that this mechanism can give rise to a notion of holographic time, as I'll try to explain. And, well, the result is that we have a particle model which is built on which is relational based on the definition that I gave. And when you just try to quantize it by standard Dirac quantization, you get that this conjecture is actually completely fulfilled. So I'll tell you about the model. The model is time relational, so it's based on an Hamiltonian constraint. And it's space relational, it's a particle model. So to be space relational means that, well, there is no absolute space in the sense of Newton. And this gives rise to constraints, which are the total momentum of the universe must be zero, and the total angular momentum of the universe must be zero. And on the top of that, we are going to require the model to be completely scale invariant, because as I said, we are going to try to explain the lack of full scale invariance and not just to assume it from the beginning. So this model is going to be invariant under global rescaling. And how can we make the model invariant under scale invariant? So any particle model which is scale invariant will present this, will have this other constraint. So the dilatational momentum d will be zero. And the closure, if you want the theory to be consistent, the algebra of constraints must close. And a requirement for that is that the potential is of degree minus 2. So you cannot really pick up the Newton potential for doing that. And so what can you do? Something, probably the most simple choice is just to take this new potential. It's V Newton over the square root of the moment of inertia. And it's a potential which is, well, it's of degrees minus 2. And it introduced this, obviously, this pathology, the fact that you have a pole of second order in the potential. But it's, in a way, the bare minimum pathology that you can have, because the only point where you are going to see it is in a total collision, when all the particles are going to sit on the top of each other. So taking this potential and just Dirac quantizing the model, you get that the Poisson bracket between the Hamiltonian and the dilatational momentum that was zero in the classical theory is not going to be zero in the quantum case. And in particular, the commutator is going to be proportional to a delta function in r equals zero, which is again the total collision in this model. So in a way, the unknown physics in the total collision is going to bring some new feature at the quantum level, and is going to be responsible for breaking the scale invariance of the classical theory. So let's have a look at the equations of the model. The Hamiltonian constraint H equals zero can be separated using this ansatz, in which we separate the radial part from the shape part, the scale invariant part, the scale invariant eigenfunction phi n. And we get a system of equations, which are a scale invariant eigenvalue equation in shape space for the scale invariant energies lambda n. And we see that, interesting enough, we get again this complexity function, so the shape minus the shape potential, which is defining the eigenfunctions on shape space, and coupled to each equation that is defining the eigenfunction on shape space, there is a radial equation that can be suggestively rewritten for this gamma n, which is the logarithmic derivative of the radial eigenfunction u. And well, the radial equation is just an energy flow equation. It's a Kalman-Simansky equation for the following beta function, where the sigma n are just functions of the shape Hamiltonian eigenenergies. So what's the basic picture? We have now solutions of the shape Hamiltonian, and coupled with that, we have a renormalization group flow equation for this un or gamma n. So in these gamma n's are running couplings, and when the scale of our toy universe changes, these gamma n's are going to be renormalized. Actually, I should say that it's not really the scale of the toy universe that matters, but it's always ratios of scales which counts. So all the model is still defined in dimensionless terms. But as you change, then you quantize your model, you have an anomaly that destroyed the full scale invariance of the model. And you have this, that these couplings constant gamma s are just coupling constant in front of the shape eigenfunctions. And as you change the radius of your toy universe, they are going to modify the relative weight of the shape eigenfunction gamma n, giving rise to a flow of probability in shape space. But a flow of probability in shape space, so the shape of the 2 degrees of freedom, is just what we would call time evolution. So I'll just tell you why we found this model interesting. So first of all, because it's just a toy model, but it's a mechanism by which a single global degrees of freedom is singled out by a quantum anomaly, starting from a model which is fully scale invariant. And this may be a way to explain the lack of full scale invariance in gravity. And at the same time, we get a nice proposal for a solution of the problem of time, at least in this toy model, which is this radial degrees of freedom that becomes physical through the anomaly just behave exactly like a renormalization group flow. And this renormalization group flow is leading to an evolution of the shape degrees of freedom. And I think there are interesting open questions, which are, for example, these gamma s, they present different behaviors at different shape and eigenenergies. So for example, there is a regime of shape energies in which these gamma n's are just flowing between two conformal fixed points of the renormalization group flow. So even if the model is breaking scale invariance for every finite radius, the infinite past and the infinite future of the model are still conformally invariant. And so an interesting question is that can holography can be linked or even arise from relational principles, because we didn't put any notion of holography in this model and we got something very similar to holography. And there is another shape energies regime in which the behavior is not between two conformal fixed points, but it's a limit cycle behavior. So there is all interesting, there are all kind of interesting properties that just arise from these relational principles. And obviously the big question is to understand also if some of these mechanisms could work even in shape dynamics, which is obviously the interesting theory. And thank you very much for listening.
Questions?
So if I wanted to be devil's advocate to this idea, I could say you should really look for an anomaly-free quantization. If you put your initial ontology on this closed system of constraints, of first-class constraints, then you should try to find a quantization that is anomaly-free. And in at least in the quantum mechanical models, it's possible that there is issues in the field theory to do that. So do you have like an answer to why you choose a particular quantization, which then of course gives you in this result of a scale anomaly, and why not be guided by an anomaly freeness from the onset?
Well, I've just taken what I would thought was the fully relational paradigm, which was really taking also a model which is fully scale invariant and not just not scale invariant like, or volume preserving conformal transformations in the case of gravity. And then I just followed just that Dirac quantization. I wasn't trying to make the quantization anomaly free. But in a way, I mean, the fact that there is an anomaly is like telling us, I mean, I think, but maybe it's wrong, that in a way, when nature is a kind of, that doesn't like the full scale invariance. So maybe the message from, at least from this toy model, is that there is no standard Dirac quantization procedure that allows you to quantize the model and to carry to carry scale invariant through the quantization. And so, I mean, and then I thought that maybe that's could be a way in which the lack of scale invariants may arise. I don't know if I...
There will be quantization schemes that
you multiply with the Hamilton constraint with an appropriate power of R before quantizing.
That would be the same, yes. And as I noted that one would argue that that would be a quantization scheme that one could prefer, but first of all, this is the simplest thing. You argue that because of the ontology that you're assuming. Here, you're not. The standard interpretation of this sort of results is that scale invariance is broken. But if you're really describing everything on shape space, you could reverse the argument, say it's just time that is getting. There is no real scale, it's just you're still describing everything with wave functions
like
on shape space.
I like that story better.
So, yeah, that's just another story. An interesting model for that reason. I've seen other hands up.
Well, I was only going to make a comment about, two comments. First of all, as I understand Tim's comment, is that quantization is a very ambiguous process, that there's lots of scope for changing the results. And without firm experimental evidence, it's a bit difficult to choose between them. But on the way Matteo put it, saying, for some reason, nature doesn't seem to like full-scale invariance. I mean, I think the point that perhaps we didn't quite emphasized in our talk so much, Flavio, was the difference between the fully geodesic theory, which is the one which Matteo has quantized, and the one that is Newtonian theory. It's just one more parameter is in it's the difference between a point and a direction on shape space and a point and a tangent vector on shape space. But the second one leads to structure. So I conjecture perhaps nature's first principle is to create interesting structure. And it may do that in one of two ways. It may start off with a classical theory which is not fully scale invariant, or it may happen through quantization. So I think the issue is open at this stage. But that the universe creates structure is manifest.
All right, are there other questions? Let's thank Matteo again.